Good morning. It's 7 a.m. and 75 degrees in Central Park. We'll see a high near 84, and it will be mostly sunny this Thursday, June 10th, 2021. You're tuned to listener-sponsored and non-commercial free speech radio, WBAI New York. Coming up next, a new day. Take a look at the new award-winning documentary that examines the complex racial histories and contemporary politics of Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Stateless is the name of the documentary by Emmy-nominated and Sundance-winning director Michelle Stevenson. It'll be playing at this year's Tribeca Film Festival starting this Sunday, June 12th. Ahead of its national broadcast release on PBS's POV on July 19th, we'll speak to the film's director, Michelle Stevenson. But first, with no parade this year, Puerto Ricans and allies are coming together to elevate the Boricua agenda. We'll welcome Justice Committee's David Galarza and New York's Boricua Resistance Rafael Agosto Miranda to talk about the events taking place later today and over the weekend. Stay tuned, for it's a new day.
How sweet it would be if I
Good morning. If you've ever been in New York City during the summer, you may have found yourself suddenly immersed in the sounds of salsa and surrounded by bright Puerto Rican flags, lots of them. Of the more than 1 million Puerto Ricans who live in the state of New York, over 700,000 live right here in the city. They represent 8.9% of New York City's total population. The sounds of salsa and sea of Puerto Rican flags are never more ubiquitous than on the second Sunday of June each year, the designated day of the Puerto Rican Day Parade. But the parade is not just about fun and music. It's a day to celebrate Puerto Rico's rich culture and a day of protest and resistance. At least until the pandemic hit, that is. With no parade this year, some folks are gathering to elevate important issues, those facing the Puerto Rican diaspora and the Caribbean island. And here to talk to us about the events of this week, we welcome to the show Rafael Agosto Miranda, the current education officer for the New York Boricua Resistance, grassroots people's organization dedicated to educating, organizing, and mobilizing the Puerto Rican diaspora in New York City for a free and anti-capitalist Puerto Rico and for the rights and welfare of our communities here in New York. We also welcome back to the show David Galarza, a longtime member and leader of the Justice Committee, a grassroots organization with an almost 40-year history organizing families who've lost loved ones to the police. And the project is to build a movement to end police violence and systemic racism in New York City. Our guests are here early this morning, Rafael Agosto Miranda and David Galarza. Welcome to A New Day.
Thank you so much.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure, especially in advance of the postponed Puerto Rican Day Parade. Can you talk to us about what's happening tonight? You're calling it Fuera Luma, and it's happening at Union Square from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Rafael, talk to us about Fuera Luma.
Sure. Thanks so much for having us on and allowing us to talk about this tonight. It's a really important issue. So for months now, almost a year, there was talks in the works about the privatization of Puerto Rico's energy grid. Many know that the energy grid had been suffering for a long time since Hurricane Maria, where people were out of power for even up to a year in some places in the archipelago. And so in the last year, you saw the formation of a corporation called Luma Energy, which is actually a joint corporation between an energy company in Canada and an energy company in the United States. So it's a U.S.-Canadian corporation that was formed specifically for the purpose of acquiring the contracts to privatize Puerto Rico's energy grid. So this is a corporation that never existed before. It was created specifically to get this contract. And so it did acquire the contract, and that contract went into effect last week on June 1st. And the moment that it went into effect, thousands of people throughout the archipelago lost power. In fact, even now, you have large parts of the archipelago that are in and out of power, some people even up to a week. So people are losing, food in their refrigerators. You have a very large elderly population in the archipelago that are dealing with the effects of not having power. And additionally, this contract was an over $1 billion contract in a time when we know that the Fiscal Control Board, La Junta, right, is imposing all these austerity measures upon the people. When people call the support, center for figuring out why are they out of power, they are being spoken to in English many times instead of in Spanish. So it's also something that's difficult for a lot of people to navigate. And then additionally, they're seeing their electric bills go up even as high as $700 for the month, with additional charges that they're not sure where they came from. So this privatization bid has really decimated and worsened the energy crisis in Puerto Rico since the last week. And so tonight we're gathering to join in with the people in the archipelago who have been protesting for the past few weeks against this contract, and actually for the past few months. The workers of UTIER, the union that manages the public energy grid, have been protesting for months. And now we have this private monopoly over the energy, which is also privatizing water supplies. So, thank you.
David, do you have anything to add to this outrage? We're talking about a $1.5 billion contract with Luma.
Yeah, no, thank you, Rafa, for bringing all of that to light. No pun intended, I guess. It's a massive contract filled with massive loopholes and all kinds of corrupt, fine writing, whatever. Rafa mentioned the water the embalses, the reservoirs in Puerto Rico would become under the control of this private corporation. And we know how vital water is throughout the world, but especially in a place like Puerto Rico. We're looking at this privatization as not only, an attack on the largest public entity right now in Puerto Rico, but as the beginning of a further privatization of other public entities, be it Centro Medico, the largest Puerto Rican hospital, public hospital on the island, to even the privatization also of the University of Puerto Rico that's currently also under attack and is being, its budget is being slashed by hundreds of millions of dollars. So it's like, you know, we already seen in Puerto Rico the privatization of the airport, San Juan, the privatization of the toll system and the highways, the privatization of hotels that were once owned by the government. This is further continuation. There's also the privatization scheme by HMS to privatize the ferry system going back and forth from Vieques and Culebra to Puerto Rico. So LUMA, you know, if they're successful, and there's a lot of pushback at every level of society against this contract, is, you know, if allowed to go through, it's also going to mean or signal one of the biggest attacks on independent unions in Puerto Rico. La UTL has been one of the more militant independentistas, in terms of ideology, in terms of sovereignty, supportive unions on the island. And this is a clear assault on worker rights. And it's very concerning, too, because we understand that a U.S.-based union, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, has workers on the ground in Puerto Rico that are basically acting as scabs or strike breakers by taking the jobs of these workers. And one last thing about that, too, is that these workers that have dedicated their lives to this, to sustaining electricity for the people in Puerto Rico, especially after Maria, where, you know, we heard the U.S. government, you know, used Whitefish and other agencies and other private concerns to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, and they didn't, you know, and they were scandalous and they were corrupt contracts. These are the workers that actually did the job, even though it took months to bring back electricity to Puerto Rico. And they're being reassigned to jobs as custodians, as security guards, as nursing assistants, and all sorts of scandalous titles like that. It's a real clear assault on the workers and working unions in Puerto Rico.
I'm speechless, honestly. Rafael, you want to add to this? Esto es un escándalo, como diríamos.
Yes.
What?
Absolutely.
Talk to us some more about the workers, unionized workers, who are being displaced, and if you know anything, and about the American Union that's contributing to this disaster.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we also have to look at this for what it is. As David said, it's not only LUMA. They're really looking to privatize everything. And so this is a real neoliberal attack on Puerto Rico and on Puerto Rico's workers, right? And especially unionized workers. In Puerto Rico, the minimum wage is still the federal minimum wage. It's just $7.25, right? One of the ways that people are able to find jobs that pay more is through these public jobs, which offer a unionized job, right? So UTIER is one of the probably most protected union jobs in Puerto Rico that you can get, or was, right? Right now, what they've been doing is LUMA used a good portion of the money to actually build a training school to train people in their way for their plans for the energy grid, when you already have all of these workers who have already been trained, and they haven't rehired for the specific jobs that people have had. They haven't rehired a lot of the UTIER workers, only a small percentage. You have then these scabs that are coming in to train in the school and to get the jobs that, these workers have historically held. Yeah, it's really a neoliberal, grab at everything that belongs to Puerto Rico. It's a further decline of quality jobs for people in the archipelago, which we know is only going to rapidly cause more displacement, right? We lost about almost close to 12% of our population in the last decade in the archipelago. And so this is just going to accelerate even more this kind of displacement to the point that, you know, we really have to wonder in a few years if we're going to even see the same Puerto Rico that we grew up with, that we know and we love and that we've, you know, have family in. It's really a matter of urgent need to address.
David, tell us about the demonstration that's happening this afternoon, this evening from 6:30 to 8:30 at Union Square to protest the privatization of the electric company.
There are two. Rafa can talk in length about the one tonight, that's directly at LUMA, and I could talk about the one on Sunday that's a little broader, in terms of the context. But to just address one last item on the LUMA contract, you know, we're at a crossroads right now in Puerto Rico where we can continue to rely on fossil fuels and continue to harm the environment and harm the lives of Puerto Ricanos, in terms of fossil fuel usage and the toxicity of fossil fuels and combustibility and the dangerousness of that, those gases and oil and coal ash. Or we can go toward a solar energy sustainable future. And right now, LUMA has its eyes on the billions of dollars that are finally going to start flowing to Puerto Rico from the federal government that Trump denied for years and that Biden supposedly is going to start, letting loose. And this money should be used to create that kind of sustainable future for Puerto Rico. There's absolutely no need in Puerto Rico to continue to run on fossil fuels where mm-hmm. everybody can have solar energy or wind energy or other forms of sustainable energy. That's really the energy future. You know, Casa Pueblo in the mountains of Adjuntas has proven it, has been the model for such a case. And so that's really, kind of like where we're at in terms of that crossroads. And then there's groups like Queremos Sol and Casa Pueblo and others that are saying really clearly, we don't want fossil fuel. We don't want LUMA. Even the electrical workers in Puerto Rico are down with a sustainable energy future. We're talking about La Utiel because they're members of Queremos Sol. So it's really important to support that effort in Puerto Rico because we can really be a model for sustainability. And, we have others that want to continue to export fracked gas from the United States, like New Fortress Energy, and continue to bring that gas to Puerto Rico to keep Puerto Rico hooked on fossil fuels for decades to come.
Right.
Rafa, you want to talk about tonight's LUMA demonstration?
So LUMA is promoting natural gas as the main source of energy on the island. Yes, tell us about the demonstration, Rafael. And who put it together? I imagine it's a number of folks that are coming together to make this happen tonight.
Yes, so it's a number of grassroots people organizations. So Call to Action on Puerto Rico, organization that has been around for a few years now, that has been really promoting what has been happening and talking about what has been happening in Puerto Rico. Also Pro Libertad, which has been fighting for the Puerto Rican political prisoners for many years here. And then also the Puerto Rican Independence Party, the New York chapter, and then our organization ourselves, New York Puerto Rico Resistance. So we're the four organizations that are calling for the action tonight, but there are many other organizations that will be joining us and many other people who I believe are agitated by this issue as well. So the rally is going to be tonight in Union Square from 6:30 to 8:30. We are going to be there to speak out against this privatization and these neoliberal plans for Puerto Rico's energy and what's happening right now. And our demands are pretty simple. They're pretty much echoing what, the people in the archipelago are asking for, which is cancel the LUMA contract. Respect the wishes of the Puerto Ricans in the archipelago to not have their power company privatized. And not only that, but if you can spend, if the government can spend $1.5 billion for a foreign energy contract that's, still fossil fuels, it could have invested that instead to rebuild the infrastructure for renewable energy and have kept it public, right? If we have that amount of money to do that. So that's our demand, is that invest in free, clean, public renewable energy, abolish La Junta as well and cancel the criminal debt, and abolish the suicidal Act 60, 20, and 22 tax breaks. And then, of course, Independencia para Puerto Rico, because at the end of the day, what we recognize is as long as we are a colony, the United States will always be able to control and to act at its whim against the wishes of the people. And so it really requires Puerto Rico, you know, literally taking the power in its own hands and being free from U.S. intervention and U.S. imperialism and colonialism in Puerto Rico. So those are the main demands for tonight's action. We'll be there at 6:30 tonight, and we will be, you know, echoing, like I said, what many groups on the ground in Puerto Rico have already been calling for, from Se Acabaron las Promesas to Utier. And so we'll be there tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is a clear example of disaster capitalism. Essentially, Puerto Rico is once again for sale. And people have been massively displaced so that more Puerto Ricans live outside of the archipelago than they do there. The diaspora is larger. Can you talk to us, David, about Plante Bandera, which is also happening at Union Square beginning at 11 a.m. this Sunday?
Sure. Thank you. So, yeah, like you said, Joanna, the 9 million Puerto Ricans, give or take a few thousand here and there, about 3 million or so in, on the actual archipelago, and 6 million places like New York and Florida and Massachusetts, Chicago, and so forth. And there's been a long history and tradition of Boricuas in the diaspora getting involved with, you know, important vital issues that are going on in Puerto Rico, from the campaign to release Oscar Lopez Rivera, to the campaign to stop the Navy bombing in Vieques, to a more recent campaign to stop a gas pipeline from being built through the center of Puerto Rico, destroying a lot of, you know, natural habitats and so forth. So and the reason why it's so important for the diaspora to be involved and active in all of these battles is because you know, like Rafa said, it's a U.S. colony, Puerto Rico, and a lot of the decisions that are being made for the island and for its, you know, and for our families back home are being made by agencies that are based in places like New York. For instance, the Junta, the unelected and accountable 7 members of this fiscal board that was implemented by Obama and that continues through the Trump administration and after the Biden administration, has its offices at 26 Federal Plaza. That's where FEMA is also located, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and the Environmental Protection Agency. All of those agencies are you know, Puerto Rico falls under their jurisdiction. And that's how come it's important for us to always, you know, apply pressure to those pressure points and know that, you know, let them know that our brothers and sisters and families back home are important to us and that we're going to fight, you know, for their rights to clean air and water and good jobs and so forth, and also continue to fight, you know, obviously to free Puerto Rico, because that's, you know, like Rafa said, been the ongoing dilemma with Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico can't form its own trading partners. Puerto Rico doesn't have its own sustainable economy. Puerto Rico has to rely on imports of food and all kinds of supplies. You know, it doesn't, you know, it has to import, you know, basically just about everything that comes into the island. And then to add insult to injury, those goods that are imported into the island are taxed through the Jones Act and, you know, made even more expensive because every boat that goes into Puerto Rico has to have a U.S. flag and a U.S. crew before it unloads. So Sunday we're going to have, an encuentro, a plante bandera, a gathering of Boricuas, you know, from all different sectors, whether it be from the environment, housing, health, education, you know, just to come together. And we're going to have speakers address a number of different issues related to those different topics. Unfortunately, Puerto Ricanos, both on the island, on the islands, you know, the archipelago and here, continue to confront some dire situations in a lot of those areas. And we want to uplift those issues both here, you know, the diaspora confronts, and also uplift the situation on the island. We're going to be hopefully blessed with a delegation of folks that are coming in because there's an important film that didn't get as much attention last year and unfortunately really should be getting more attention this year, which is called Landfall by Cecilia Aldarunda. And it's a film that documents, has been documenting, you know, what Puerto Rico was going through before Maria, during Maria, and after Maria, because, you know, we know we've been dealing with natural catastrophes like the hurricanes, but we've also been dealing, more importantly, with a man-made catastrophe that's the so-called fiscal crisis. This oppressive regime called the Junta that's been driving all the austerity on the island, that's been, you know, closing down hundreds of schools and displacing workers and families and so forth. And the hope is that, you know, upon completion of this this program, that folks will continue to work together on all these different issues and concerns, because we know that when we work together, like we've demonstrated again with Oscar Lopez campaign, with the Vieques campaign, with the Gasoducto campaign, when we work in tandem and get our leadership, especially from the frontline groups on the islands, we can do a lot of things. We can accomplish some wonderful, wonderful things for the people back in Puerto Rico. And aside from all this privatization that's going on with Luma and the ferries in Vieques and Culebra and the Junta and the UPR cuts, Rafa also mentioned these horrible tax loopholes that are driving this mass, you know, migration of rich people from the United States to Puerto Rico to cheat on their taxes and buy massive amounts of land. There's a violent land grab going on the coast and inside in the interior parts of the island. There's also an ongoing epidemic of femicides and gender violence that needs to be addressed. And, you know, there are many, unfortunately, many, many of these issues that we're confronting. But we know that collectively, when we come together, we can make great, wonderful things happen, both for the diaspora, but more importantly, for the motherland. And so we invite everyone to come on Sunday. We always know that the Puerto Rican Day Parade is not just for Boricuas, but everybody's Boricua, especially on Sunday. But beyond Sunday, we need to get to work. We need to roll up our sleeves and try to make things as right as we can for the people back home that continue to suffer the injustices of colonialism and extraction and capitalism, all violence.
David, you've mentioned, and Rafael, all of the elements of U.S. colonial rule, or colonial rule generally, the imposition of English language, the fact that people are calling the electric company and being forced to speak in English. I've heard last I checked, Puerto Rico was the fifth largest consumer of American goods. So essentially, Puerto Rico has been the piggy bank for a faltering American capitalism since the 1950s. We see the mass displacement of Puerto Ricans out of the island because of the crisis that the colonial government has imposed there. And then there's the massive land grab, right? I'm sure that this company is getting all of the works. $1.5 billion welfare check, essentially, mm-hmm. to come set up mm-hmm. shop. These are all the elements of colonial rule. As one of our producers says, Marcos, or said to me, Americans love to fight for injustice everywhere, especially on the left, and somehow Puerto Rico is missing from the equation. Your own backyard is what we on the left have to begin to address immediately. Thank you both so very much for joining us. We welcome people to join the demonstration tonight at Union Square, 6:30 to 8:30. PM. And before that, I'm getting a message. The Women in Black will be out there in support of Palestine, I think, 5:30 to 6:30. So 6:30 to 8:30 is Puerto Rico, 5:30 to 6:30 is Women in Black at Union Square, 14th Street. And then this Sunday, June 13th, Plante Bandera. Also a gathering beginning at 11 a.m. this Sunday at Union Square. Thank you so very much for joining us. We've been listening to Rafael Agosto Miranda, current education officer for New York Boricua Resistance, and David Galarza, a longtime member and leader of the Justice Committee. And we've been talking about the crisis in Puerto Rico, the privatization of the electric company, and U.S. colonial rule and its ravages on the island. Thank you so very much, both, for joining us.
Thank you, Joanna.
Thank you for having us.
And it's great that, you know, there's an action for Palestine and Puerto Rico going on virtually at the same time, because we stand in complete solidarity with the people of Palestine. As Carlito Rovira, a young lord, always reminds us, what's happened in Palestine is perhaps the most violent manifestations of colonialism. And we know that from Palestine, from Puerto Rico to Palestine, occupation is a crime.
Absolutely.
Free Puerto Rico and free Palestine. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's 7:30 and 75 degrees in Central Park. You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day.
Yo sé que no.
And that was Planté Bandera by Tommy Olivencia y su orquesta con Chamaco Ramírez. And it seems that this week, without planning it, Latin America is on our minds. Today we turn to the problem of racism against Haitians and Dominicans of Haitian descent in the Dominican Republic. We do so through the lens of an award-winning feature film that examines racial ideology and contemporary politics in both Haiti and the Dominican Republic. The title of the film is Stateless, Apátrida, in Spanish, and it's the latest documentary by the Emmy-nominated and Sundance-winning director Michelle Stevenson. The film follows the grassroots campaign of a hopeful young attorney named Rosa Iris and her bid for public office. And the film uncovers multiple levels of racism, both structural and ideological. The film develops against the backdrop of attempts at the extermination of Haitians during the 1937 Haitian massacre by the Dominican military, which claimed the lives of tens of thousands of Haitians and Dominicans of Haitian descent on the island, in the Dominican Republic. The film also develops in the context of Law 16813, passed in 2013 in the Dominican Republic, which established that only persons born in the Dominican Republic to Dominican parents or legal residents can be considered citizens. The draconian immigration law canceled the citizenship of tens of thousands of people whose parents and grandparents the law identified as undocumented dating back to 1929. In essence, the law denationalized people who had been considered Dominican during all their lifetime, many of whom were registered at birth as Dominican nationals, and who throughout their lives had been granted other identity documents such as identity cards, electoral ID cards, and passports. The law is known colloquially as la sentencia, the sentence. The ruling rendered this category of people stateless and created a situation of denationalization of a magnitude never before seen in the Americas, effectively rendering more than 200,000 people, once again, stateless. The film is screening this week at the Tribeca Film Festival, and it will premiere on PBS's acclaimed documentary series, POV, on July 19th. And here to talk to us this morning, we welcome its director, Michelle Stevenson, who's a filmmaker, artist, and author. She tells compelling, deeply personal stories that are created by, for, and about communities of color. Her films reimagine and provoke. She is a Guggenheim Fellow and a Creative Capital artist. Her feature documentary, American Promise, was nominated for 3 Emmys and won the jury prize at Sundance. Her most recent feature, Stateless, is nominated for a Canadian Screen Award. The film will be playing again this Saturday, June 12th, through Sunday, and also on June 20th, ahead of a national broadcast release on PBS's POV on July 19th. Michelle Stevenson, welcome to A New Day.
Oh, thank you so much, Joanna, for having me.
So tell us about you. I was going to ask you to talk to us about the protagonist in your documentary, Rosa Iris. But first, tell us about what brings you to this story.
Well, in some ways, the film has a very sort of personal resonance for me. I'm from the island. I'm originally from Haiti. I was born there. My father is Haitian. My mother is from Panama. And we left when I was very young, under the dictatorship of Duvalier. We fled. Most of my family left. But I, you know, grew up, would go back to the island regularly for holidays. We have a family in Dominican Republic, family that has married Dominicans, and so I grew up sort of knowing both sides of the island, but also understanding the depth. There was always conversation at the table, often about the depth of Dominican-Haitian relationships that were very complicated, you know, that kind of reflected both how we internalized white supremacy, but also how there was resistance too, and collaboration, and family relationships across the island, too. So when the sentencia happened in 2013, I was just coming out of a long tail that we did of community engagement with American Promise. And I felt really compelled to... The stories that I tell, the stories that I work on at Rada Studio with my filmmaking partner and life partner, Joe Brewster, really come from a personal space first. And the films and the stories are always about challenging our assumptions, but also complicating and giving a personal voice to what is systemic. And so it's very important that there is that personal connection. And so when the sentencia happened for me, it became also an opportunity. We talk a lot about race here in the United States. The films that we do are very anchored in the question of the racial caste system and racial oppression, but I felt the need and compelled to go do some research, see what kind of story could I tell from a diasporic lens as a Black immigrant myself here to the United States, and trying to understand, but not just understand, but really reveal the depth of how white supremacy works in these spaces. And so I had done some work with some Dominican organizations in the past around the earthquake, as well as with some women's movements before that around the conference, the World Conference Against Racism. And so I had connections. And with the earthquake work I was doing, these were small, short pieces that were done for Black public media. It was really about highlighting the collaboration between young people in the DR and Haiti that were trying to demystify, fight against stereotypes, and really provide some assistance. And through that network, I kind of found Rosa Iris back in 2014. She was working with the Reconocido, which is a an organization that's led by Dominicans of Haitian descent to fight for recognizing their rights as citizens. And she was in a Baté, in a sugarcane community, and I spent the first day with her just following her and the work she was doing to try to find loopholes and ways to give people papers in some way that they could at least get a job or work. And I kind of, you know, fell in love with her presence and her aura and her commitment. And so, you know, fast forward, what, 6 years later, Stateless sort of came out of that relationship. But, you know, going back to myself, it's a very personal sort of journey for me on multiple levels, both being from the island, that motherland, but also understanding the depth of the racial caste system that I see both in my family as a light-skinned Haitian American woman, and really trying to crack that open and see the extent to which, you know, there's both the internalized oppression part of it, but also the systemic and the bureaucratic sort of genocide that is happening.
European colonization of the island, both Spanish colonialism and European and French colonialism, played a number on the people of that island. Tell us, before you talk to us about white supremacy and its ideological and structural manifestations, talk to us about Rosa Iris.
Rosa Iris is a fierce warrior. She was born in San Pedro de Macorís in Dominican Republic. Her mother is Dominican. Her father is Haitian. But her mother goes back a few generations and is also of Haitian descent, which you will find with many Dominicans. There's some Haitian ancestry in many of our fellow islanders in that part of the island. And she grew up in the Baté. She grew up in the sugarcane community and sort of fought her way through the system with, I think, a very fierce mother as well. I think for me, this film is also about women and the work that women do, the fierceness with which she sort of tries to address the issue is something that we see unfold. And on top of that, she's also, there is a level of some kind of faith in the system also, because she decides to become a lawyer, and then she also decides to run for office. So there is this sort of burn inside her, too, to figure out how to make the system work as well. So there is a bit of a faith in that. She has not completely sort of opted out in the sense of sort of thinking that there are ways within the system to try to make a difference, but we see that slowly sort of erode a little bit in the film, but she keeps fighting. And so she is an eternal sort of optimist. Today she is in, was granted asylum and lives in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where she's actually graduated and got an LLM in humanitarian human rights law, just graduated last month. and is providing services and working with migrants from Central America. So she sort of like continues sort of the work. And she's also fierce about recognizing, understanding the depth of what internalized oppression looks like, and is a fierce defender sort of her Afro identity also with her circles.
Where did she get her her degree in Pittsburgh?
Oh, American University.
Huh.
So she came here, and American University offered her scholarship. I think through the Human Rights Network that she was involved in last year, and finished her degree just last month, her LLM. So we're very happy for her.
So she got asylum. Tell us a little more about, because she was stateless?
No. She is not stateless. So let me dial back on that. Rosaides is a citizen born in the DR and has, I guess, for lack of a better word, legitimate papers as the state recognized, because her mother is Dominican and does not have sort of that immediate lineage to 1929.
Her mother's Haitian ancestry predates the 1929 limit.
Exactly.
That the law establishes.
Exactly.
On that side,
she was able to trace sort of. So she was not in jeopardy, but she has cousins who are Teofilo Murat, who is in the film, who was born in the DR also, and is her cousin, is stateless. After, you know, having multiple passports, having traveled, you know, the world, and completely losing all of his, economic security as a result of becoming stateless. Because of the sentence.
And was she under threat for her work in the Dominican Republic?
Yes. So this is the other side of the coin that we sort of, we touch on a little bit in the film, and we reveal is the extent of the violent hatred, the anti-black hatred that exists in the country. And she was receiving death threats. She was receiving threats against her son, against her. Her mother was very afraid. There were unknown people who were sort of, you know, hanging around the Bate, where she no longer is a part of, but where her mother and her family are a part of, to kind of increase the threat. And then there were very direct sort of social media threats as well, which is, as we know, is quite common now. It's a vehicle, right? It is a device, a tool used by ultranationalists, social media, and death threats. It is not unique to her. I know of activists in the Black Lives Matter movement in places here in the United States that receive daily threats on social media as well. So she was able to make a very strong case to seek asylum against this. And interestingly enough, she was granted asylum in 2017, end of 2017, which is, when Mr. 45 was in power, which is interesting that we had a Republican government when she was granted asylum. So, she was able to make a strong case, and we reveal some of that also. And she has colleagues and friends who were killed, people who were beaten up. So this is also my friend, historian, Dominican historian, Eddie Paulino, talks about this, that this may be a very unique case to be granted asylum against the Dominican Republic, because often people don't think about government repression or other kinds of repression in the DR. They think about it more on the Haiti side and how it behaves to the extent that you can actually meet, you know, the requirements for being granted asylum. So I think also the fact that she ran for office and was starting to uncover, you know, the level of corruption also put her life in danger. So it's that intersection of the work she was doing to fight anti-blackness, and then and her work in government trying to expose corruption.
And the threats are leveled against ultranationalists and neo-fascist forces in the Dominican Republic. Those same forces have harassed activists and organizers who are challenging Barrick Gold, the gold mining company that's wreaking havoc on the island, and it's Rio Ozama. Can you talk to us about some of the scenes? What are some of your favorite scenes in the film?
Wow. There are, I mean, some of my favorite scenes. I think some of my favorite scenes, I think one of my favorite scenes that stand out for me, and maybe because I'm more sort of I'd like to reveal and work with the complicated nature and the personal and the emotional, is the scene where Rosa Iris, and we get really a sense of her connection to community that I feel is a gem. I'm so happy we were able to document, is her relationship with these four young Dominican men of Haitian descent. She comes to see them, and they talk to her in such a way of they love her. In a sense of they love what she represents, and it seems like she's been a guiding light for them. And what is revealed in that scene is one that basically they are invisible, and there's very little option for them to be able to gain the papers that they need to be fully productive citizens. And for those that are able to do it, one of the young men come in and was thankfully is actually part of, interestingly enough, is a part of a police force, and he comes in with a uniform, and he works in the tourist segment of the DR, where many of the this community sort of provide services, and she breaks down crying because he reveals to her that he's got his papers, he's got his citizenship. But he still has to hear the trash, the micro and macro aggressions from people, you know, accusing him of, you know, not being here in the right place, to go back to where he is, that, you know, with his, you know, dark skin person, and using the slurs that they use against Haitians, against Dominicans of Haitian descent, and so she sort of breaks down as a result of it. And I think it's a moment of frustration, but also of love and community when we see her with them. I think that's one of my favorite moments. I think for me as a filmmaker and a storyteller, I felt very, not just privileged, but felt really so happy that we were able to make work these magical realist scenes that are basically an ode to our collective memory, and bringing back, you know, a commemoration for the people who suffered in 1937 and died. There are these interstitial moments that reflect the journey of a young woman by the name of Moraime, who was killed by the military in 1937. She's a fictitious character, but she's really more of a composite of what everyone sort of suffered, trying to get to Haiti, to the other side of the island, trying to get to Haiti before the military would capture them. And so it was very important for us to reveal that story in a lyrical, sort of magical, realist way, so we can absorb the violence, but in a way that is that honors what they went through, and understanding that someone like Rosa Iris sort of stands on their shoulders, that there's a cyclical nature to this violence, and that today you don't need a machete. All you have to do is take away people's papers and they no longer exist.
Talk to us about magical realism. What is it, and how exactly do you render it in the film? And we have very little time left, like
okay.
3 minutes.
All right. Well, so very quickly, I mean, I think for me, growing up, you know, as part of this Caribbean diasporic community, magical realism was sort of part of how we absorb, not just stories. I was just talking earlier about stories my grandmother would tell us about what she lived through under the Haitian occupation, the U.S. occupation of Haiti. But they were told in ways that were inspiring, and sometimes maybe they were flowery too as well. But magical realism for me is a way of processing pain in a way that provides strength to community, right? And so it, for me, was not just a way of trying to honor 1937, but also honor the way we tell stories and share community and build sort of inspiration to keep fighting. And so with this film, we use sort of lyrical imagery and sort of churn perception on its head and trying to make even the sugarcane fields, the mountains, young children, silhouettes, bring beauty to that, understanding that beneath that, there's so many layers of suffering, but that still we rise. And so that was sort of the intention around sort of using this way of seeing and of telling stories.
This reminds me of a conversation I was in yesterday. The New York City Book Awards ceremony, and a young woman by the name of Sarah Sierra, she's not a woman, she's a child, got an award for a book called Becoming Kid Quixote. And she told the story of how her mother told her that she crossed the border on a lion, that the lion took her over the border, and she talked to the lion, and the lion talked to her, and she was able to get through safely. The way a mother tells a daughter about a very, very difficult, unforgiving experience, the passage over the border. Michelle, we have run out of time, but I'd like to continue this conversation next week. And perhaps we can invite Eddie Palomino to talk about this crisis in the Dominican Republic as we continue to flesh out how magical realism is amplified in your film. I'd love to do that.
Oh, I would love that. I would love for Eddie to join us. That would be amazing.
Yes, and this conversation is near and dear to my heart, as I am Dominican, and have written about the crisis and the white supremacy in the Dominican Republic and its origins. So I thank you, and our listening audience thanks you for this gift to the world.
Well, thank you so much.
You've been listening to the voice of Michelle Stevenson, who's a filmmaker, artist, and author. She tells compelling, deeply personal stories that are created by, for, and about communities of color. And her stories reimagine and provoke. She is the director of a feature documentary, Stateless, which is nominated for a Canadian Screen Award. The film will be playing at this year's Tribeca Film Festival this Saturday, June 12th, through Sunday, June 20th. And it is going to be featured as a premiere broadcast release on PBS's POV on July 19th, and she will be back with us hopefully next week to continue this conversation. Thank you so very much, Michelle, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to non-commercial, listener-funded community radio, WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. It's 7:58 a.m. and 75 degrees in Central Park this morning, Thursday, June 10th, 2021. We're rebuilding the world together and ushering in a new day. This show is produced by Ajamo Sankofa, Alex Maxwell, and Marcos Maldonado Cruz, and a special thanks for the production of the show to Marcos Maldonado Cruz. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. We leave you with Levántate Negra by Xiomara Fortuna. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. See you tomorrow. Levántate, more.
Levántate, negra, levántate, more, que mañana ya vendrá.
All right, we have just a few seconds before the top of the hour. This is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. Did you hear what Rafael Augusto Miranda said? Thank you for having us on at the beginning of the show. Thank you for having us on to talk about this important topic. A $700 electric bill in Puerto Rico.